Bit of a mix-up about who was going to do the Bible study, so I'm sorry if anyone came expecting him.
I see lots of disappointed faces as they walk in. So I thought today, you know that Min Iski finished the book of Acts verse 2 weeks ago, and then last week he did the book of Philemon just as a fill-in chapter, and then this week was also going to be a fill-in chapter until we start the Gospel of St. Mark next week. And so I sort of started preparing a few different pieces, and I wasn't really sure what to talk about, and eventually I thought it would be nice to read something from the Gospels, and I settled on Luke chapter 8, verses 40 to 59. So we're only going to read part of the chapter. So we'll read from Luke 8, verses 40 to 59. But to really understand this passage, there's so much that happens in Luke chapter 8. It's actually an enormous amount of stuff that happens. And I thought we could just quickly just recap some of the stuff that happens so it sort of makes sense by putting it into context. So the chapter starts off by the Lord being surrounded by some of the prominent women in his ministry, and one of whom is Mary Magdalene, from whom he cast out 7 demons. And then the next bit of this chapter is that the Lord tells a couple of very famous parables, including the parable of the sower. And then his mother and his brothers come to him, and they want to talk to him. So he gets called from outside saying, "Your mother and brother want to talk to you." And then he comes up with that famous line that we all know, which says that my mother and my brothers are these who hear the word of God and do it. And then the next thing that we read in this chapter, chapter 8, is that the Lord gets into the boat with his disciples. He falls asleep. A violent storm overtakes the boat. The boat's about to sink. The disciples fear for their lives, and so they wake up the Lord. He rebukes the oceans. He rebukes the winds and everything. And then he rebukes the disciples for their lack of faith. And then the last event that leads up to what we're going to read tonight is straight after this, his disciples and the Lord get into the boat and they depart from Galilee where they were to a city called the country of the Gadarenes. And from what I read, this was a city that was directly opposite the city of Galilee on the other side of the lake. And basically what happens is they get into the boat, they go. And when they arrive there, they're greeted by a madman, a man who's possessed by many, many demons, and his name is Legion, referring to the number of demons that he's got in him. And the Lord casts out the demons, and he takes them out of the man, puts them into these pigs. The swine go off the edge of the cliff, they drown, and then the entire city of the Gadarenes comes out and asks the Lord to leave. They're not happy that the Lord's there. Unfortunately, to their shame, they're not happy that he's there. And so where this story takes off, where we're going to be reading from tonight, is when the Lord comes back from the Gadarenes back to the city of Galilee. So I might just ask somebody with a loud voice if they could be our designated reader for tonight. Okay. Or I might just read it for the sake of the recording. So chapter 8, verses 40. Just verse 40. So Luke 8, verse 40.
So it was when Jesus returned that the multitude welcomed him, and they were all waiting for him.
Yeah. So we see straight away in this chapter an enormous difference that's happening between the Gadarenes and the Galileans. It's actually incredible. He's just left this country of the Gadarenes where he was asked to leave, and not a single person apart from this demon-possessed man welcomed him. And he returns to the Galileans where he's actually welcomed, and not just that, but people were waiting for him, meaning that they were sitting on the shore actually waiting to hear him. You know, they were so eager, he was so popular there, he was so loved. It just goes to show you how personal the Lord's touch is for each of us. You know, we all know that the Lord is all-knowing. We all know that that's one of his divine attributes. And so this instance suggests that the Lord must have known that he was going to go to this town, travel, you know, spend the whole day at this town, and be rejected by the entire town. He knew that in advance, and yet he still went for the sake of this one man. He could have easily stayed in Galilee, where the people loved him to the point that they were welcoming him back. But he chooses not to do that. He leaves this city where he's so popular, and everybody loves him, and everybody's chasing him. He leaves it all for the sake of this one man. And, you know, it's actually really incredible, because in the eyes of the world, this would have been a real disaster. It would have been a real failure. Like, it would have been a waste of time that the Lord would leave an entire city that he could win all these people and make them his disciples and his followers so that he could go to another city, be rejected, and the only person that would be accepted of him is the man that was rejected from everybody else anyway. So in the eyes of the world, he wasn't worth much anyway. But he does that for the sake of this one man. You know, sometimes we read about the Samaritan woman, and I'm sure we've all heard about how the Lord had a personal touch for her, and he travelled 6 hours to go and talk to her and so on. But I think that this miracle is actually more strong in terms of the Lord's personal touch, because in the instance of the Samaritan woman, the Lord knew that the entire city of Samaria would come out and accept him. So he went for the sake of the Samaritan woman, but in his foreknowledge, he would also know that the city of Samaria would come and believe in him, and he spent days with them. But here, he went for the sake of one man. He knew that the Gadarenes would reject him, but he knew that this one man needed salvation. And so he went and travelled for this man. He left the 99, as he teaches us, for the sake of the one. It's a really comforting thing for us to know that the Lord loves us individually to that extent. But it's also a lesson for us to learn from. It's a lesson for us about how to serve. That we should never really feel we should be serving in the places where we're just comfortable, you know. A couple of weeks ago, we went door knocking with a Woonamark to some of the neighbours. And it was a very uncomfortable, at least I found it very uncomfortable, knocking on, you know, people's neighbours, and not the most comfortable thing that we're used to. And what I found is that as we started to door knock, whenever we came to, for example, a Greek Orthodox house and there was a big cross, you felt relaxed and you felt comfortable and you felt you could talk about what was going on. But when you went to a house and you're about to knock and you saw something that was very anti-Christian, or, you know, beer bottles everywhere, or an environment, or a barking dog, or whatever it was, you would feel in yourself that, you know, I don't feel comfortable here, and you'd want to quickly say what you need to say and just sort of get out of there, or at least that's the experience that I have. It's kind of like in Sunday school when you're serving in a class and there's always that kid who's really difficult to serve and who's not very engaging and doesn't warm up to you very well. It's very difficult to serve him, but it's very easy to serve the ones that are loving and warm. But that's not how the Lord looked at it. The Lord looked at it completely different. He chose the most difficult one to serve, the demon-possessed man that was rejected and alone, and he went and searched for him, and he left his popularity and he left his followers for that sake. And I think it's a beautiful example for us. So if we go on to verse 41.
And behold, there was a man named Jairus, and he was a ruler of the synagogue. And he fell down at Jesus' feet and begged him to come to his house.
You know, Jairus was a really special man. Like, he was the ruler of a synagogue, and there's so much that we can learn from Jairus. Back then, the ruler of the synagogue wasn't just a man. Like, he wasn't just a spiritual religious leader. The synagogue was the central hub of where everything happened, which is why it was such a huge deal if somebody got kicked out of the synagogue. You know, it was where the trade happened. It was where they came to worship. It was where people came to meet and greet. It was where people came to get advice and sell and this and that. And so the ruler of the synagogue was not just a religious leader. He wasn't just a rabbi. He was actually someone that was intimately involved in the lives of people and had a real influence on the people. And so, in a sense, he was a man who was really revered, respected, kind of like almost like a little king, highly respected by his people. In many senses, he actually reminds me of my dad, when you're old, like, in the same degree that people involve him in every aspect of their lives. And, you know, I remember one story, just diverse for a second. I remember one time I got a phone call. It was at home, and I answered the phone, and it was this woman that was struggling to breathe. Like, she was really, you know, is Abuna Ya'ub there? Like, really struggling. And I said, oh, look, he's not here, he's at the monastery, but can I take a message for him? She said, oh, can you call him urgently? Because I need to know if I have to go to hospital now or not. I said, what do you mean? Like, she's like, oh, I'm pregnant, I'm about to have a baby, I don't know if I should go to hospital or not. Like, this is a true story. So I said to her, did you call your husband? She's like, no. Did you call the ambulance? No. Did you call your midwife? No. Did you call your doctor? No. I just called Abuna. I said, I think maybe you should call an ambulance. She goes, no, I can't call an ambulance unless Abuna tells me to call an ambulance. I said, he's at the monastery, and back then there was no reception at the monasteries. And I said, oh, look, you know, he probably won't be able to get back to you for a day. She's like, all right, just tell him to call me when I get back. So I said, all right, just 1 second. Like, I'll confess, I put the phone down. I said, I just spoke to him, and he said, call an ambulance. So, I hope she called an ambulance. But it just goes to show, like, the role that, like, the priest has in the life of these people. And this is what Jairus was to these people. Like, he was like everything to them. You know, they respected every word that he said, which then puts into context the amazing thing that he's about to do, which is he comes to the Lord, he throws himself down at the feet of the Lord, and he begs. You know, this would have been a shocking scene for the Jews. Like, this man that they respected and revered and loved and hung on to every word of what he said, was throwing himself down at the feet of a layman. Like, it's like Pep Chodras comes up to us and just sees one of the youth and throws himself down and says, help me. You know, like, it would have been a really confronting scene. And I really believe that some of the strictest Jews, the real Pharisees, would have not let this go lightly. They would have said, you know, you're the ruler of the synagogue. How could you embarrass us? How could you shame yourself like this, and so on? But we see Jairus' humility in this. We really see that he may be the ruler of the synagogue. He may be revered. He may be respected. He may be honored. He may be involved in every aspect of their lives. But it doesn't stop him. Like, in the presence of the Lord, I am nothing. Like, it doesn't matter what the world thinks of me. At your feet, Lord, is where I belong, and at your feet is where I'll beg. It kind of reminds me of, like, when our Coptic Pope, for example, on the Easter and Christmas liturgy, reads the gospel. The first thing he does is he takes off his crown and he puts it next to him, saying that in your presence, when I read your word, Lords, I'm not king, I'm nothing, I'm just not worthy to be called or honoured in the presence of the one from whom honour originates. I remember my dad told me a really nice story when he was at the monastery. A few months ago, there was a delegation of Coptic bishops here. And you know, when a Coptic bishop is here, we honour them to the point where we kiss the ground before we kiss their hand. And so these Coptic bishops are used to being honoured and respected. It just so happened that particular day, there was an Armenian, Pope, who was visiting from overseas, and he was at the monastery. And my dad said he was, like, really touched by the way that these bishops ran, you know, these bishops who spend their life being honoured, ran to kiss this Armenian Pope's hand as a brother or sister church, the Pope. And it just goes to show that they have that real humility that Jairus had. And so I think we should apply that in every aspect of our life. Like, I may be the best teacher in the world, but in the presence of the Lord, I know nothing. I may be the best engineer, I may be the best pharmacist, the best doctor, whatever. But in the presence of the Lord, it doesn't count for anything. So if you go on to verse 42.
For he had an only daughter about 12 years of age, and she was dying. But as he went, the multitudes thronged him.
And so we see here what Jairus wants, and that is, he's begging the Lord to come and heal his daughter who's dying at home. And I imagine that this must have been a torturous scene for Jairus, because he knows that every minute that he delays the Lord coming to his house is a minute that his daughter is closer to death. But there's thousands of people thronging. Everybody wants to come and touch the Lord and talk to him and so on. It must have been torture. It's kind of like when you've got an exam and you're on your way and you're desperate to get there and you're stuck behind a truck and you can't move and you've got to go really slowly. Like, it's really torturous. So imagine the desperation that Jairus feels at the moment. Verses 43 and 44.
Now a woman having a flow of blood for 12 years, who had spent all her livelihood on physicians and could not be healed by any, came from behind and touched the border of his garment, and immediately her flow of blood stopped.
You know, something that I was fascinated by in preparing for this Bible study is how closely linked these two miracles are. You know, so these two miracles are mentioned in the first three Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And what I was amazed when I was comparing the accounts in the three passages is that in all three passages, the two stories are linked together. And in all three stories, the story of Jairus starts, it's interrupted by this woman with the flow of blood, and then it continues with the story of Jairus' daughter. So it's not like it's two separate miracles that are being recounted. And it just goes to show that the Holy Spirit is very keen to show that these two miracles are very, very linked, closer together. We see in this woman who comes to approach the Lord, a woman who is desperate, like Jairus was desperate. She's tried everything. She's spent everything that she has seeing doctors to try to get a cure for her problem, and nothing's worked. And it must have been very, very distressing for her. And so in her desperate state, she says, well, what if I come to the Lord and I just touch him? You know, I'll be healed. The more that I thought about what this woman did, the more I really came to appreciate and love this woman. I don't think that we really get a sense of just how much this woman risked by what she did. You notice that the gospel clearly says that she approached the Lord from behind. Why? Why would somebody approach the Lord from behind if they're trying to get his attention? It doesn't make sense. Like, if you're trying to get closer to someone, you want them to be before you so that the distance between you is constantly getting closer. So as they move, you're moving closer towards them. And you can see them, and you can see where they're going, and you can sort of, if they move left, you go left. If they move right, you can go right. But when someone is away from you, they're always going away from you. So it gets harder and harder to approach them. So it begs the question, why? Why did this woman approach from behind? And I think, personally, that the reason that she approached from behind is that she was ashamed of what her condition was. You know, to have a flow of blood back then is not a sanitary condition at all. And what's more, if you remember the rules and the laws of purification of Moses in the Old Testament, a woman who had a flow of blood was not allowed to be part of the assembly of the Lord until her bleeding stopped, which meant that she was unclean and everybody that she touched or came in contact with was unclean. And more than likely, people would have hated this woman and, you know, gone out of the way to not go near her, because to go near her or to touch her or to be in her presence automatically meant that you were defiled and unclean. And so all her 12 years, she must have been known as the dirty woman. She must have been known as the diseased woman, the woman who, if you came into her presence, you would be defiled. And so for her to go into a crowd was an enormous thing. Like, people would have recognized her and seen her. And the reason that she goes from behind is that she hopes that people are distracted with the Lord, that they're so busy trying to get to the Lord, they don't see her. She's probably covered up with her face covered, trying to touch the Lord from behind. You know, it's a really brave thing of this woman to do, and it's a really humble thing of this woman to do. And her faith in the Lord must have been unshakable. Even from a medical perspective, what this woman does is amazing, because to be bleeding for 12 years meant she would have been anemic, she would have been low in iron, she would have been dizzy. If you've seen somebody, a patient, who's had 12 years of bleeding, it's like, it's unbearable, you know. They can't even lift their head off the bed. They're just exhausted. Even to just talk to them sometimes is exhausting for them. And so for this woman to be walking, probably in the heat of the day, desperate, pushing through crowds, being shoved left and right and centre, and trying to get through to this crowd to reach the Lord, gives us a sense of how amazing she was and how desperate she was to touch the Lord. And so I guess the question for me tonight is, how desperate am I to touch the Lord? Like, how prepared am I to go through and push through the troubles and the effort and the heat and the shame and people pushing me left, right and centre to touch the Lord? How desperate am I? How sick do I spiritually feel that I can touch the Lord at any expense? If you notice something beautiful, that St. Luke is very keen to highlight the similarity between these stories, that the woman has a flow of blood for 12 years, and the woman has a flow of blood for 12 years, and the girl who's dying is 12 years old. And the father's comment that this wasn't a coincidence, that the Gospels clearly document that. St. Cyril says that the Lord clearly said that he of himself, "I am the resurrection and the life. So I give resurrection to the daughter of Jairus, I give life to the woman who is bleeding and dying slowly, because I am the resurrection and the life." St. Ambrose commented, a contemplation, not an explanation, but a contemplation, that in a sense the dying daughter of Jairus represents the Jewish nation and the bleeding woman represents the Christian church. Because the dying daughter, in order to be resurrected, has to die and the Lord has to be the one to resurrect her, meaning that Judaism had to die, it had to be resurrected as Christianity. But the Christian church, which is already alive but has its own diseases and its own problems, needs to always touch the Lord to be healed. So in many senses, the dying woman represents the dying girl represents the Jewish nation. The Christians are represented through the woman of the flow of blood. So if we read 45 to 48.
"And Jesus said, 'Who touched me?' When all denied it, Peter and those with him said, 'Master, the multitudes throng you and press you, and you say, "Who touched me?" But Jesus said, 'Somebody touched me, for I perceived power going out from me.' Now when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling, and falling down before him, she declared to him in the presence of all the people the reason she had touched him, and how she was healed immediately. And he said to her, 'Daughter, be of good cheer, your faith has made you well. Go in peace.'"
So the woman touches the Lord and then she's immediately healed. And the Lord turns around and asks this slightly unusual question. He says, "Who touched me?" And St. Peter asks the question that probably most of us would have asked if we're in the same situation. Like, you know, everyone's around you touching you, Lord. Everyone's coming to you, pushing you from here and there, trying to get closer to you. And you ask, "Who touched me?" Like, the question probably should have been, who didn't touch you in this context? But I really love this question that the Lord asks, "Who touched me?" You know, all our lives we're taught that it's the Lord who touches us, and that's true. You know, all our lives we're taught it's the Lord who extends his hands and touches me. He's the one that touches me and gives me repentance. He's the one that touches me and gives me purity. He's the one that touches me and opens my eyes to behold him. But tonight's question is different. Tonight's question that the Lord is asking is, "Who touched me?" Not, "Who did I extend my hand out to?" but, "Who extended their hand out to touch me?" It's a very important question for us to ask, "Who touched me?" Who touched me to declare their faith that by touching me, they would be healed? Who touched me to declare their faith that by approaching me, they would be cleansed and purified and could leave behind their own life? I especially love this question because it was not for the Lord's sake that he was asking this question. He wasn't asking this to know the answer, because we know from many, many other passages in the scriptures that the Lord knew, he could read people's thoughts. He knew the future, he knew the present, he knew the past. We know that our God is an all-knowing God. And so this question that he asks is not a question that he asks so that he knows the answer of who touched him, but rather it's a question that he asks for the sake of the woman, not for his own sake. And the reason that it's for the sake of the woman is that the Lord was not satisfied with just curing her physically. You know, he wanted to restore this woman. He wanted to go the extra mile, as he teaches us. This woman would have had 12 years of shame, 12 years of being excluded from everybody, 12 years of being forever known as the dirty woman, the woman who no one wanted to go near. But the Lord, in his mercy, wants to publicly restore her. He wants the entire town to know that this woman is clean now. He wants the entire world to forever remember her, not as the woman who had the disease and the filth and so on and the bleeding, but to forever remember her as the woman with the incredible faith. Like, we're still reading about her 2,000 years later and what she did. And it's almost like the Lord wants to go that extra mile. And it's such a touching, touching incident that the Lord went above and beyond what she asked of him. Like, all she wanted was to touch him and him to heal her. He went far beyond what she had ever hoped for, where not only did he touch her, not only did she touch him and be healed, but he actually restored her in the sight of the entire village and the entire town. And it's really a really nice thing for us to learn tonight. So we'll just read verses 49 to 56, then we'll conclude.
And while he was still speaking, someone came from the ruler of the synagogue's house, saying to him, "Your daughter is dead, do not trouble the teacher." But when Jesus heard it, he answered him, saying, "Do not be afraid, only believe, and she will be made well." When he came into the house, he permitted no one to go in except Peter, James, and John, and the father and mother of the girl. Now all wept and mourned for her, but he said, "Do not weep, she is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed him to scorn, knowing that she was dead. But he put them all out, took her by the hand, and called, saying, "Little girl, arise." Then her spirit returned, and she arose immediately. And he commanded that she be given something to eat. And her parents were astonished. But he charged them to tell no one what had happened.
So we come to the second miracle in this passage, which is the daughter of the raising of the daughter of Jairus. If you just put yourself in Jairus' feet for a moment, like, Jairus has just seen this incredible thing happened. So he's gone from being very scared that his daughter is going to die to seeing this incredible miracle happen before him, you know, where the Lord touches and heals this woman. And then just as his hope starts to increase that his daughter is going to be saved and raised safe from the dead, they immediately come to him and they say, "Your daughter's dead. You know, that's it. It's finished. Don't trouble the teacher anymore because he's dead." And again, in his compassion, the Lord turns around to him and he doesn't want Jairus to lose hope. So he says to him, "Do not be afraid. Only believe and she shall be made well." In other words, what he's saying is, what you've just seen happen to this girl, to this woman, I will also do for your daughter. I will save her in the way that I just saved this woman. And it must have been something incredibly comforting for Jairus. And I think we see here an example of how the Lord works. Sometimes, you know, the Lord puts things in your life and you think, "Lord, why now? Like, I'm already busy enough with these problems. I already have so many other distractions and so on. And I can't handle this thing that's going to stop me from doing what I need to do." I imagine that for Jairus, he must have been itching for the Lord to rush to his house. He must have been wanting to just pick up the Lord, pack him up, you know, put him, carry him on his shoulder, and just run to his home before his daughter dies. The last thing that he needed was a crowd of people, and the last thing he needed was a woman to come and take the Lord away and slow him down. The Lord talks to him and talks to her, and Jairus must have been thinking, like, "Lord, come on, you know, like, she's going to die if you don't come quickly." And yet, the Lord puts this encounter for Jairus to behold. And in fact, it's actually the exact opposite. This was the very reason, instead of it being a distraction for Jairus and a distraction to the healing of his daughter, this is actually the very reason why his daughter was healed. Because if you remember, that the Lord only placed one condition on Jairus for his daughter to be healed. And that condition was, "Only believe and she shall be made well." In other words, if you believe, she'll be made well. If you don't believe, she won't be made well. That's the promise that the Lord gave to him. And so it's very possible that had Jairus not seen this miracle just happen, it's very possible that he would have gone to his house and at the last moment started to doubt and think, "Oh, is the Lord really going to be able to raise her from the dead? You know, I had faith that he could heal her, but do I really have faith that he's going to turn around and raise her from the dead?" Probably not. You know, probably Jairus would have got there like any of us. I said, well, it's too late, she's dead, exactly the way that these people from his house sent him the message. But it's only because of this miracle that Jairus has just seen the power of the Lord, that he has enough faith and belief in the Lord to feel that when he gets there, that the Lord will be capable of raising his daughter from his dead, from the dead. And so this very incident that initially seemed like a distraction or a, you know, an annoying kind of thing happening is actually, in fact, the very reason why the Lord is able to heal and raise this daughter from the dead. And so it's so often in our lives that happens. Like, so often in our lives, the very thing that we think, this is the worst possible thing, this is the worst thing, I can't see any good come out of this, is the very reason for us to receive blessing from the Lord and for the Lord to work amazing miracles in our lives. In verses 52 and 53, we read of how the Lord says to them that, you know, she's not dead, she's sleeping, but they turn around and ridicule him. And that's a very comforting thing for us, because that happens so often in our lives. Like, whenever someone doesn't have a belief in the power of the Lord or in the Lord's existence or anything like that, their automatic response is to turn around and ridicule and mock us. I remember when I was at uni, I had a biochemistry subject, and I used to hate it, like really, really hate it. And I was walking into an exam, and I had in my hand a little picture of Christ that I used to carry on my exams and put on my desk. And I was walking with a friend, and very nice person, but very anti-Christian, just openly atheist and stuff. And the whole way that we were walking to the exam, we happened to get off at the same train station. We were walking to the exam, and the whole way, when she saw the picture, all she did was just criticize and mock and saying, you know, oh, does Jesus know biochemistry? You know, oh, does he know how to do it? I said, well, actually, he does. He knows the, you know, the formulas and stuff. And she just looked at me like I was a nutcase. You know, actually looked at me. She ended up being hit by a car, by the way. Not that. But that, like, no, well, we probably should have stopped that. But anyway, like, no, she didn't get hit by a car then. Like, she got. Anyway, I'm just going to leave that story. But anyway, so, like, it's just the natural response of people. Like, you know, they have this natural tendency that if they don't believe in God, like, it's almost like a natural response. The next step is automatic to ridicule. Like, how often do you see people say, oh, okay, look, I don't really believe that, but I respect your beliefs, or, you know, it'd be interesting, I could learn more about it. Very rarely. It's just usually, you're so old school, you're so backwards, you know, who believes in that, you know, who still believes that marriage should be between men and women, you're stupid, you're old fashioned, you're this, you know, get with the times, all that kind of stuff. That's the natural reaction. It seems like it was all throughout history. So when we read this, and we see that this happened to the Lord himself, like, it's so comforting, you know, like, if this happened to the Lord himself, then who am I to get upset that, you know, Carrie from exams is making fun of me because I have carried a picture of Christ? Or, you know, like, it's really touching to see that the Lord doesn't impose things on us that he himself didn't experience. And so I think we'll leave it at that for tonight and learn that the many lessons from this passage. You know, there's so many things that happen in this chapter. We've only chosen two of the major miracles. But may we spend the night tonight in prayer thinking, like, answering the Lord's question, who touched me? You know, did I spend tonight in prayer, coming to the Lord, pushing through my fatigue, pushing through my boredom or my thoughts straying or whatever? And did I push through the crowds of tiredness and of everything else and laziness to touch the Lord and to receive healing from him tonight? And glory be to his name forever. Amen.
Any questions?
Yeah.
Why do you think he told them not to tell anyone at the end?
Yeah, one of the fathers, I can't remember which father it was, actually commented that I don't know if this is the father or the contemplation or an explanation, but what he was saying was that the Lord didn't feel that the people around, because he took sort of an inner circle in, and he took the mother and father in. And I think the explanation that Saint Cyril was saying is that the people around were not worthy of seeing and believing of what had happened. And so it was almost like they had rejected the Lord by ridiculing him and not accepting him. And so it was almost like their hearts were hardened, that they wouldn't see what had happened. And another explanation that I read was that he didn't want, he took the inner circle in to see it so that they could be certain that it was raised from the dead. There were the two explanations that I read. So they didn't deserve it, or weren't worthy of knowing the intricacies of what, because they didn't believe, and they probably wouldn't have never believed. They ridiculed from the beginning, which meant they probably would have ridiculed and said, oh, it never really happened, she was really asleep, she wasn't actually dead. Or,
yeah. Yeah. Well, I can just imagine Jairus looking so hard for him, like, mm. see his daughter dead, and then being raised from the dead, and all that.
Yeah.
It's impossible not to tell it, I think.
Very difficult for him.
At the back, Abuna Mark has provided refreshments at the back, so feel free to socialize at the back. And Abunia will be with us next week.
How are you? Hey,
good. Hi, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you.